For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'll be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy, chasing the fame, playing the game. It'll be too easy, but tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and per usual, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strath. What's up, Kent?
I am unseasonably warm. I don't mean in here right now. I mean, it's Indian summer. Super tired of it.
You know, I've never understood what Indian summer was.
It's when it gets, it's like when summer's, oh, I mean, not officially.
But
over.
To answer your question, Niles, yes, it probably
you
is.
What,
like, Kent
like,
is a racist.
Very likely.
Kent
global
is a racist.
Native
warming.
American, Native
global
warming.
Bite me. Blame it on the natives, right?
That's not a real thing.
So we,
alternative facts.
So, Indigenous American summer?
Original. Too many syllables.
It's original.
Original
American.
Summer. Yeah.
Original
summer.
No, it okay. is a OG summer. Thing because I think it was that the native folks were seen to give gifts and then take them back, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, the Indian giving thing.
Indian giving. So okay, I think it's related to that. That it's like it's
I
like,
feel like the internet has this answer.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Kent, you are unseasonably warm.
Yeah.
Not that I subscribe to that.
Okay. I'm just ready for this to be over.
You ready for fall. Summer to be over?
I'm ready for fall.
You ready for fall to get here? Okay. Well,
fall is really the best.
Speaking of fall, I love fall because so this episode is going to be about masculinity. So give me a second to be misogynistic for just a second. Get this out of my system. I always love when summer rolls around because I'm a leg guy. And so girls come out in their shorts.
Oh, that's what you're talking
and then,
about.
Okay. And then when summer goes away, I'm like, no, the legs are going away. But then jeans and boots come out. And I'm like, yes, jeans and boot season. That's good as well. But putting that away,
okay, hold on.
It is now pumpkin spice season.
Let me ask you this. If you're a leg man and you go, oh, jeans and boots are awesome, isn't that kind of like saying, I'm a boob man, boy, I really like burlap sacks?
No, because when boots push butts up.
Depends on the cut. Depends on the cut of the jeans.
Yeah, and if you have boots on, and once you put the boots on, it changes things.
Okay,
that also depends on where and who you're looking at, because sometimes it doesn't matter.
True story. Yeah,
sometimes you don't need boots.
Yeah. So
also, I don't know if that's misogynistic. I'm gonna be honest.
Okay.
I don't know. If
anybody's out there, like,
just to scratch on the surface of the discussion, like, I don't think that misogyny means you don't appreciate women.
Okay.
Or don't appreciate the body.
Okay, well, save it till we get into the questions.
No,
okay,
man,
so that's good. That's good stuff.
Right now.
sort of like color blindness, right? Like,
right. I don't see color. No, you're racist.
True story. So, I remember when I was in high school, I was at this conference. I was working in youth ministry at the time, and I was on the campus of Wheaton University in, I think it's in Illinois. But either way, yeah, Chicago, South Barrington, Illinois, whatever. So we're at Wheaton, which is where Billy Graham went to school. And there was this lady who was trying so hard to describe me to the leader of our group. His name was Craig. Tried so hard to describe me to the leader of the group without describing my color. Mm. Now, bear in mind, I am the only black guy in this group.
in Wheaton, Illinois. Yeah. Big surprise.
What are the odds? But I mean, our group came from Detroit, right? So, but our students.
I have been there, and that's totally true.
Yeah, totally. It's, so anyway, so we show up in Wheaton, Illinois, and this lady's like, "Yeah, so he's wearing the cargo shorts, and he's got the glasses on, short."
This lady's a short South Park character.
Dark hair, and Craig's like, you mean the black guy, Calvin? And she's like, well, I don't see color. He's like, but he's black. I'm like, I don't understand how you don't see that. Like, everybody here is white. That is a super easy descriptor. But all that said, the fall, beyond the pants and the boot season being back or coming up, pumpkin spice is back. And I saw the nastiest thing I have ever seen. The nastiest thing I've ever seen yesterday. Pumpkin spice hot dog recipe where you take a hot dog. You make whatever it takes to make pumpkin spice, so like cinnamon and pumpkin, and you put it in like one of those squeezy cake batter things, and you squeeze it down into a hot dog. You put it in a bun. Into
a hot
dog?
Into
a hot dog. I didn't see them cook the hot dog, so I'm thinking the hot dogs must have been cooked beforehand. They squeeze it into the hot dog, and then they put whipped cream on it.
Calvin.
And then they
can
make
I tell you something?
It's so nasty.
White people are the problem.
It is. It seems like this is not a race episode, but yes, that is a white people issue.
That thing you said.
That's
about,
a white people issue.
And Matthew, you need to get on this. And
Matt,
like
call your people.
Like only you can talk about police brutality and the problem with pumpkin spice. That is you need to talk to your people.
So we were at Trevor.
It's
Noah's.
Your issue.
You need an our issue shirt,
right.
And that is about
so
pumpkin spice for you.
We were at Trevor Noah's comedy thing in Windsor a few months ago.
Okay,
and you know Trevor Noah?
Yeah. South African.
So, right. So
and
he
runs a TV show that's pretty popular. I've heard of.
Sorry, but so he did have this whole thing about like white people's cooking. Must have been so bad because they started this whole journey across the world to find spice. They went looking for spices, right? Like, and so like how bad. So we don't need a day without a Mexican. We don't need a day without, you know, people of different backgrounds cooking for us. We just need them to keep their spices out, right? And then everyone will stand up.
The disrespect of it is that white people, to your point, and I saw this on Tumblr probably 2 years ago, white people had the nerve to conquer the entire world in the name of spices, and then not use the motherfuckers when they cook.
Why is it so like, bland, right?
Why are you seasoning this with almonds?
How
you
can we make
season
this hot,
something with
how
almonds?
How can we make this hot dog better? We'll inject it with frosting, basically. Right?
Essentially, and then put more
mayonnaise
frosting on top of it.
Mayonnaise is not a flavor. Yo.
That's nasty. Like, anyway,
put some hot sauce on that hot dog.
Can I speak for
of the other white guy
from the perspective of the listener? We've not done introductions.
We have not.
Totally confused.
Which is what I'm getting to. Okay, so all that said, we got way off on this pumpkin spice thing, which is funny, but I mean it's true. It is a problem. Matt, get on that.
Call my people.
We're starting a new series this week called Battle of the Sexes. We're starting off week one with What is Masculinity, and we have two guests with us today. The first guest, where actually both of these guests have been on the show before, but not in a while, so we're welcoming back to the line first Mr. Niles Heron. He's a writer, dropout, founder, entrepreneur, growth consultant, activist, abolitionist, believer in black girl magic, resistor. He's actually wearing a shirt right now that says resist on it, so it's kind of appropriate and cliche at the same time. I don't know what we're doing. Is this okay?
I forgot I sent you that bio.
Okay.
I wouldn't have worn this.
Disruptor, born in Detroit, after moving and living for 7 years time in Los Angeles and San Francisco, he moved back to Detroit. Now he uses entrepreneurship as a tool for economic development and equality, as he likes to call it, entrepreneurship as a solution. Niles, welcome back to the line.
Thank you for having me.
Also back in studio is Matthew John Schmidt. Matthew is the author of the blog Dismantling Righteousness. Yes, you heard that correctly. And a co-founder of The Table Setters, a new nonprofit dedicated to moving diversity training beyond workshops on tolerance and more towards learning to depend on culturally integrated lives. In 2016, he moved back from Los Angeles to the east side of Detroit with Darcy and their two daughters. They are working closely with local churches and community developers to mitigate the increasing pressures of gentrification while loving the ability to live cross-culturally and get to know their neighbors through conversations porch to porch. Matthew, thank you so much for being on the line again.
Thank you.
So this episode is about masculinity. It's going to be an interesting series. So starting off this week with what is masculinity. Next week we're doing part two, what is femininity? Did I say that correctly? Did I say that correct? I always say it wrong.
Nuclear.
Correct. And then the last week will be Mars, Venus, and gender fluidity. But this week we want to focus specifically on masculinity. So this week, just guys. Next week, just girls, and the third week is kind of up in the air. We're trying to get some pretty diverse voices of men born men who identify as men, women born women who identify as women, women born as men, men born as women. We're trying to get a diverse group of voices, but the first 2 weeks will be traditionally, genetically, men and women. But either way, the first question we want to ask is what vision of men did you have while growing up? What did manhood look like to you as you were boys? As we were all boys, how do we envision manhood?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. My father is a writer and a poet and an intellectual. And I think he was a deep thinker, and certainly to my knowledge and in my view, treated women with respect. He also wasn't cool. He wasn't a cool guy. You know, my dad was never going to like say, here's what you should say to that woman.
Or, okay.
Here's how you should, you know, like fit into the broader society. So the question becomes like, what is the view of masculinity that we embrace? Because I was looking at my dad like, he can't dance. He's a cool guy. He's really smart. As an adult, you know, I've learned a lot from my father, but he certainly wasn't like the prototypical alpha male, like, you know, kind of North Star in terms of like how you fit into a culture that is really predetermined. Like you step into it. It's not one that you create as a child. It's
right.
One that you're indoctrinated into. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think that that's where I would at least start, is just to say that like my father is certainly the view of a man that I grew up wanting to be for a long time. And also very much recognizing like his deficits relative to the culture that I was also trying to figure out how to fit into and trying to figure out how to have friends in, you know, and not be this or that or the third or whatever. So,
okay.
Yeah, this is a complicated question for me. So I'm going to sum it up by saying I saw men as scared, and these are white men I'm referring to. And this is not to fix these men in time, but for the purposes of where I was growing up, they've changed since then and they've moved, and I've learned a lot about them. But I basically had these three archetypes of men. I had a grandfather who was just kind of an angry, chain-smoking alcoholic, and I hated him. Like, he was scary. He was always getting in fights with an uncle of mine, like fist fights.
Did he ever go through a war?
He did. He
okay.
went through...
All right.
He went through both. Yes, he went through both parts of World War II. He was in both Normandy. He was the only person on his boat to survive. So here's a little bit of his backstory on the amphibious boats. And then he was also in Japan, and he had a sword. He had a rifle that he had bested from a Japanese soldier. So this is a man who almost died several times, mm-hmm. right? And he was just angry. He was a father of nine, just drunk all the time. I had another family member who was really misogynistic and was also a really he was like my big brother in a lot of ways, but just had this view. He taught me that, you know, in sixth grade it was like, hey, have you gotten up any skirts yet? Right, like that was, or like like, do you like any skirts? Like he like skipped to the chase. Like the women were even just talked about as the item of clothing you're supposed to bust through, right? And then my father is a really quiet guy, and I've come to really respect his strength, but I always saw him as so quiet and afraid to get involved. So I grew up really hating men. I really thought men were kind of useless, actually, because they're either problematic or scary or just not solving anything.
Okay. Ken, what about yourself?
My experience... could not have been I relate to both those stories. My experience, though, couldn't have been more different with my grandfather's in that, I mean, we all have to, at least biologically. And I had one grandfather who was he had my father when he was 35, and my father had me when he was 35. So my grandfather was an old man. An old man by the entire time I knew him. He was too young for World War I. He was too old for World War II. And he was the nicest, most jovial person I've ever known. The other grandfather was... He was a veteran. He was a World War II fighter pilot. I think just in one theater. He was both a cargo pilot and that was after he was a fighter pilot, and he was also very sweet, but he didn't talk, and I don't know if that was wartime experience or the fact that he was just naturally quiet, but he was standoffish. He was physically small, and he was just extremely delicate and gentle with his movements. So he was much more of a my grandfather, who was a war veteran who literally probably killed people, though he didn't talk about it, was far more the more feminine figure of the two grandfathers that I had, which was interesting.
I grew up in a military household, so my dad
was an alpha. Your father, I've met him.
You're saying that, but no, my father was always the quiet person. He lived in a household where his mother and father were both drunks. As far as the story's been communicated to me, I didn't know either of them. By the time we came along, my dad, his mother had passed on already, and he pretty much kept us away from his dad, right? And because we're in the military, that kind of naturally happened anyway. The military was like, you're going here. It's like, oh, well, that's pretty far away from my family, so that's where we went. But because of the nature of his mother and father and who knew what they grew up with, my father was tasked with raising his brothers and sisters. So by the time we came along, my dad didn't really know how to deal with kids. And since his mother and father never came home, what my father did was he came home. He went to work. He put food on the table. He put a roof over our head. He put clothes on our back. And then he came home. And he would come home and he would go straight to his room, wash, rinse, repeat. That was pretty much it. I don't remember because it never happened. My dad didn't come to my sporting events. My dad didn't come to any of the theater events that I was involved in. Nothing. Nothing. And my mom was ever present, right? And so it's kind of interesting. But we'll talk about her next week. So my dad never really showed up for anything. And so what my mom did was we were a very, very religious family. And so my mom made sure that we went to a church on Wednesday nights. Now, something you need to understand for our listeners, I grew up in Black Pentecostalism, and during the 80s, early 90s, Black Pentecostalism, and actually really kind of to this day, is notoriously horrible for children. There's children's church, and then basically you're done with until you're an adult. That's pretty much it. There's no in between. And so my mother had us go to the quote-unquote white church down the street from our home that had all sorts of programs for kids. And that's where – and I think this is where a little bit of my defense of white people tends to come from is the examples of masculinity and fatherhood that I saw that I appreciated as a kid came from white men.
That is the title of Calvin's upcoming memoir, my defense of white people.
No, interesting. But – I had a couple of men who came alongside me, and we can go back and forth as to what they saw in me. They could have seen just a boy who needed a father, or they could have seen a poor black man, a black boy who was abandoned by his father, even though his father was in the home. Right? I've seen a lot of this in white evangelicalism since I've become more aware of my race. But either way, as a kid, I appreciated it. I was taken in. I memorized a bunch of Bible verses. I went to a bunch of camps. These guys would have me over to their home. They would carve a Pinewood Derby car for me, and I'd be in that, and I'd go to camps for a couple weeks, and there was that. And so for me, masculinity had everything to do with time spent with me, more so than the rah-rah football, rugby, UFC, well, UFC wasn't a big thing at that time, but for me, it was about time spent with me. So I did, in a way, have something that was modeled to me, but it was also kind of also the precursor to this within white evangelicalism, this precursor to what would become Promise Keepers, where like the biggest problems men had to watch out for, and it's still kind of an issue, the biggest problems men had to watch out for were women lying in wait to ruin your marriage.
I was going to say porn.
Pornography.
Yeah, okay.
Right, pornography as well. And those were kind of the things that I saw. And then also I saw kind of a Christianized version of what we'll get to in a little bit, hyper-masculinity. Mm-hmm. Lots of books came out during the late 90s. Wild at Heart was the biggest one by a guy by the name of John Eldridge. Mm-hmm. Every man I knew read this book in church. It was like the bandwagon book. There was one by the guy out in California at Saddleback Church.
Mm-hmm. Rick Warren?
Yeah, Rick Warren, whatever. Purpose Driven Life. There was that book that came out.
That's not so much about masculinity.
No. Right? I'm saying there were bandwagon books. That was one, and then Wild at Heart was another one.
I bought Wild at Heart. Didn't read it.
Okay, I read. There were Bible studies around this. There were weekend retreats around this. And that was a retrieval. That was a retrieval of this masculine nature. Something's been lost. Men have been neutered by the culture, the rise of single parent households, mostly women. The boondoggle of the buffoon dad in every sitcom. We'll get to that in a little bit in this podcast as well. So it was a reclamation of manhood, but never really a description of what manhood was.
I think it's really interesting. In a lot of ways, one of the spaces that I think we and I want to read an answer that a friend of mine gave, but I think that one of the things that we suffer from in this country and in this space, in this discussion, I hope we can get to it, is that I don't think that there are many written records of what men are. You know, I think that we're tasked with filling empty space a lot, and I think that that leads to a lot of the acting out that you see, because I don't think that there really is. For many people, I think that there are, in fact, many more written accounts and like very detailed accounts of like what a woman should
be. It's really interesting.
Right? Because men have written them. Men have said, this is what a woman should be for me. For me to like a woman, this is what she should be. We've said that a lot, but I don't think that there is anywhere near as authoritative a record of what men should be. And so I think that we have examples, but not
and implications,
right? We have inferred rules.
So because the men wrote all these things, men are the writers, right? But there's nothing that specifically says this is what...
Yeah, this is what you're supposed to do, which means that in the absence of an example, in the absence of a footstep to follow, and men are in this country specifically, but probably more broadly, really just left to figure it out.
And I think you're correct in that there is a historical lack of that. In preparation for this episode, I kid you not, and maybe it is with more so within religious circles than the non-religious circles. I'm just telling you, once the 90s hit, I don't know what it was. Before then, it was like women need to be proper. You need to you need to wear shirts that don't tempt men and things like that. There was a lot of rules for women. But once the 90s hit, I can tell you within evangelical Christianity, there was men after God's own heart. I have literally in my backpack out in my car, I've got 8 books about what it means to be a man. And I wonder if those were published because we don't know.
Well, that's my point. I mean, like when you see that kind of an influx, it's because there's such a gap, right? You don't need 8 books written. I'll tell you this. There probably are not 8, 10, 20 books written in the last 15 years about what a woman should be. Because we know.
Probably
we
not.
Know already.
Right.
Full stop. We got it.
Didn't Wild at Heart have a sister book? I forget the name of it.
It did. It was called Captivating.
That was it.
By Stacey Aldridge. And I read that with my girlfriend at the time, and that was actually better than Wild at Heart. I'll tell you that right now.
One voice that none of us can represent, though, a brother that I wanted to be here, he couldn't be here today. His name is Terrence. I sent him the questions and just asked him to think about them. Mm-hmm. And he responded, and I think it's an important piece, especially when we talk about, black households. He said, while growing up absent of a father, I didn't have a safe space to express a full range of emotions or to behave in a way that wasn't associated with being, quote, manly. I could laugh, but I couldn't cry. If I cried, then I'd be called a sissy by my mom. I could play outside, but I couldn't play with my sisters and their friends. If I played with my sisters and their friends, then my mom would say I'm going to end up being gay when I grow up. I had a habit of sucking my thumb as an elementary school age child. My uncle will tell me to get that dick out of your mouth. Because I valued their words, they always cut me deeply. I remember wanting to cry but not knowing where I could cry freely. One of the older guys in my neighborhood told me it wasn't crying if I did it in the shower. And that stuck with me for the rest of my life. That was his response to, I think, kind of the first question, like, what were the views or the visions of men you had while growing up?
Okay.
I just think it's important to remember.
No,
we all just kind of talked about having fathers in a home to some degree.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a dramatically different level of void that we spend our lives trying to fill when we don't have whatever that example is to say, you know, even just binarily, yes, no, I'm going to follow, I'm not going to follow. Mm-hmm. At least you had an example.
Exactly.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
So what do you see as the positive attributes of masculinity? And if you're quick enough on your feet, how do those differ from the positive aspects of femininity?
I think they converge, is what I see. So the stories that I told, most of those stories have, like I said, those men progress. So what I see as being traditionally seen as a woman's thing, and there's some stuff that as a parent now I see this in complicated ways, but like the mom is always supposed to make things right. Right. Like my five-year-old will say, "Mom is so much better at calming me down, Dad." Right. Like it breaks my heart. But
you've got two daughters. Yeah. Okay.
But this idea of making things right. And so.
So you own at least two guns, right?
Right. So in my head. So my grandfather, right, the one that's the raging alcoholic, he was diagnosed with both liver cancer and lung cancer. And spent the last like 4 years of his life being told that he wouldn't live for more than a few months, really like going around and making things right with people. Now I've learned later that he didn't make it right with everyone, but that man was a changed man, right?
He had like liver cancer and lived 4 years.
I don't know. Like he had lung cancer.
Okay.
And then I think liver cancer set in something, but he lived for a lot longer than he was supposed to. And I was just reflecting on this today. He got me this trophy. Like, he didn't come to any of my games. Like, he's this big sports fan, right? But I think I'm just making the connection that I didn't really like sports because watching sports meant being in that smoke-filled, yelling, screaming room with him. So I'd always go elsewhere, right? And so then, like, I'm a terrible basketball player. In fifth grade, my grandfather gets me this trophy that is a trophy of a basketball player. It's the little guy shooting that says number one grandson. And that's just like, because you weren't the number one free throw shooter, right? But I have it because there's something that's so significant about that to me. That
that's not even a participation trophy. That's the funny thing about that.
No, that actually kind of seems kind of sweet. Like he's trying.
It's sweet, you know? Right? Like, so this was a man who understood that there had been a deficit, and he went around and did the best he could. And some people were shut off to him, and rightfully so. But he did the best he could to make things right before he died. And to me, that the thing about masculinity that I find so redemptive is that power to say, you know what, I'm not. So we talk about now, as you're talking about things like there isn't anything prescriptive, but there's a lot of imagery about what men are supposed to be. You think about movies and the hero and like the Lone Ranger, all the American sort of things, like all these implied things. Nobody's written it out. But like to be that person who's like, I'm a broken person, the strength. Like the strength of that, to admit that and be able to still face everyone and not run, that to me is like real bravery. And I guess bravery is something that is maybe a traditional masculine thing, but it's a broken bravery.
I would want to be careful there to say, are we talking about what are the positive attributes of what we would associate as being masculine in this culture? Or are we talking about what we in this room today are going to say this is masculinity? Because I don't think of bravery as being a masculine trait.
Yeah, yeah.
I think of bravery as being something that men have appropriated.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And decided was a them thing.
Well, I think one of the most popular Disney movies is called Brave, and it's about a girl.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's kind of like tossing that on his head, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, like, you know, cartoons for a long time have been trying to, like, take these weird, not even weird, but overt shots at gender norms. And
yeah.
I mean, to like, be fair,
for a long time,
most
since they got
Disney
hit
movies
and stopped making all the
villains. For years it was, well, it was also for years the prince rescues a damsel in distress, and now all of a sudden this movie Brave is turning that on its head. And I love what Disney's doing.
I mean, Mulan, right? Mulan was a princess rescuing the entire country.
Frozen, where it was, hey, it's not the prince and the princess who were supposed to fall in love. It's actually like a sister love.
A giant majority of Disney movies feature women, and I don't think there's a coward in the bunch. I mean, they're all brave.
But
right?
Many of them get rescued. So the whole the rescuing has to do with the prince often, right? They're being rescued.
Not lately.
Yeah, not lately.
That's a new point, right?
That's kind of the point that we're discussing. Yeah. My question was just whether or not that is something that we want to, because I think part of this discussion has to be What has it been and what should it be?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well said.
What have we associated with masculinity and what should we now be associating with masculinity? So when I think about this question, for me, honestly, listen, I'm 6'1". If I'm feeling good about myself, like I'm feeling kind of sick today, so I'm probably like 6'1.5".
Okay. I felt a little taller than you.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah. You looked you are.
I look
normally,
huge, right?
Normally, you know, you got nothing, but today.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, I mean, like, my point is just that, like, there is genuinely some amount of protecting that I am better suited to do, generally speaking, as a man of stature, of large stature. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm 6'1", I'm 280, right? I make people feel safe. I'm never going to throw that away. I'm proud of that.
But you're associating that more with your size, right?
But my point is that men are typically larger
than
women.
Sure, sure.
So, like, that is, in fact, something that comes with that territory,
sure.
Right?
And there's something that throws it on his head. Like, today he was showing me his iPad Pro, and he was showing me how he does his poetry, right? And that's in his bio. I'm like, oh, it's like, oh, here's this guy who's 6'1", 280. He's like the guy who's making me feel safe.
He's a
Kung Fu instructor. And he's a poet, right? It's like, oh, like yeah. If I saw.
But then you've got Bran of Tarth, who's the big, in Game of Thrones, he's the big, like, right? Yeah.
6'4".
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But I think, like, four instances, what I'm saying is like, oh, there's that sensitive side to him. That's that's the interesting. Yeah. Like, when I find out about, like, my favorite wrestlers who are like these guys, like The Undertaker. Not Undertaker, Triple H. So Triple H is this big wrestler. He's married to the CEO's daughter or whatever. And he's this big guy, scared me as a kid. Mm. And then I watched a documentary on Netflix. I had all these wrestling documentaries. I love to watch them. There's one on Triple H. And you find out wrestling's not real. And here's what they're like in real life. And the guy has, if I'm not mistaken, he has three daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And his wife comments, like, yeah, who he is in the ring is totally different. That's an act. When he is at home, he is a big tender warrior, and I've used that word online with you. Like, he's tender just this warrior, big teddy bear with the girls. They never fear their dad, and he's a guy that if you saw on the street, you'd be like, that guy could wreck some stuff. And he literally can, right? But at the same time, it's like, okay, there's this idea that people who are, you know, 6'1", 280, who should be able to wreck some stuff, aren't also at the same time gentle and tender and able to. I think there's a cultural idea. It's not true.
You're 100% right, but part of that is, again, because we don't do well embracing, and I think this is probably a very consistent theme on your show, like, we don't do well in this country embracing intersectionality.
Yeah.
You know? Like, the idea that you can't, like, again, I started training Kung Fu when I was 18, and I'm 31 now. Technically, I'm an instructor. I'm not really worried about it. And yeah, I write a lot. I'm trying to think. So I've been writing.
I write a lot of poetry. Don't get it twisted.
Well, no. What I'm saying is that, like, so I've probably written 1,000 poems in the last 7 years.
Okay.
8 years. I've been in 2 fights in that time, which means I write 500 poems
per fight.
I also haven't lost either of those fights.
You're about due for another fight, apparently.
Right? Like, I'm getting to that point. You know, but, like, does that make me less of a – is that non-masculine? Like, I think that, again, we try to ascribe so much. So when you say what are the positive attributes of masculinity, again, I'm just saying I think that there is a value in being a protector.
By comparison, by the way, I've written 7 poems, and I've gotten in no fights.
You got 493 more.
Yeah, 493 more poems to write.
My poem to fight ratio is literally infinity.
You're doing really well. Okay. I'm really proud of you.
But now, see that? That's a masculine thing. You need a competition there. There you go.
But
right?
Just to hear you talk about this and to your point about, like, I'm really feeling the reality of your point that, like, we haven't done a good job, right? Like, when you brought up this wrestler, like, when you're hearing an expose on this wrestler and then there'd be, like, but he has a sensitive side, right? Like as if that's the surprise, as if that shouldn't come as expected, or that you are wondering, like, does this?
I think it's a surprise to. I think it's a surprise to the culture. I don't think it's a surprise to any father who has daughters.
Yeah, or any
because there was something that I wanted. I wanted to be a lot hard. I mean, I'm not a super hard person to begin with, but there was something a lot more hard, and I delved into that whole wild at heart thing when I was younger, and then I had a daughter, and it did. Soften me. And I don't know if it softened me because I had been exposed to this stuff that's saying you need to go out there and you need to sit in a tree blind at 6 o'clock in the morning with a gun and shoot a deer to feel like a man and one with nature. I don't know if that, I mean, that was really in there.
One with nature.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of guys I know. I was at churches.
Our cultural experiences inform so much about what we think.
Well, mm-hmm.
I've never wanted to go to nature to feel like a man.
Me either. It's 6 a.m. in the morning. But I literally went to church this Sunday, and the pastor was talking about hunting, and there was a guy who was sitting in the row in front of me who was dressed in the hunting gear. I don't know if hunting season's even begun, but he was dressed in the hunting gear when the
October.
Okay, when the pastor mentioned hunting, the guy like clapped. And I was like, I had nothing from me, nothing at all. I'm like, that's the woods. That's where white people go to get killed in horror movies. I'm not going there. But they're
or deer,
deer live there. That sucks.
That's their horror movie.
Why do we live here? Why are we born here? But either way, I lost my point.
There's a Black in America allegory. There.
Yeah, for sure. But either way, for positive attributes of masculinity for me. Yeah, that protector idea for me for sure. And I think that and how that's different from femininity. I always say this wrong. It's been brought up in several episodes. But the way I was taught, the way I was raised, and I still find value in this, is that men are natural providers. And we see things like young boys. We're natural at competition. Again, young boys. Okay, hey, you know what? We don't like kids playing cops and robbers anymore, so we don't give them toy guns anymore. It's like, you can give them a stick, and they're going to fashion a gun out of that thing. It's just kind of innate in a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, someone's going to be dominant. You see right. Every... Like, at some point, we have to recognize that we have... there is biological right. imperative right. in our action, right?
But you'll see in that cops and robbers thing, it's like the guys are trying to, in a way, defend the girls, right? And so that's what I saw as a kid.
I don't even know if it's that, and I think that actually oversimplifies things. What I see really consistently
Well, I think
is
kids
that,
are simple. In a way, they don't have all these thoughts that we're having about what is masculinity, what is femininity. It's, hey, she's a girl, I'm a boy, I have the gun, I need to stop the robbers from trying to kidnap her.
When you use inductive logic to get to a point and then use deductive logic to get back away to another point, you end up in a really different place.
But adults do that. I'm talking about
kids.
I
feel like you're doing that, and I feel like the specific sentence that they are trying to defend the girls as opposed to possess, like the word defend. In that sentence is the only thing that I actually have any concern with.
Okay.
And I just don't see it as being defend. I see it as being, like, possess.
Okay.
Because I don't think it's like, I'm going to defend you so that you can now go do whatever you want to do in life. I'm going to defend you because now you're mine.
Right.
You're my girl,
and
so
I can,
I'm going to defend
you. I can see the mixture of that. Like, the guy's trying to rescue the damsel in distress from the dragon.
And now you
belong
to me.
Right.
Because I saved
you. I love those comics where the girl's like, wait, just because you rescue me, you think you could just kiss up on me like this? Like, that's not cool. And I was like,
But I think that when you look at the way kids act, and genuinely when you look at any other, specifically mammal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always think of like rams fighting or gorillas fighting. I mean, like, it is absolutely about reproductive right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that, the idea that that isn't something that really does exist within the biology of the world for the most part is silly. And I think it's important to think about that only because when we talk about how evolved we are as humans and we love to think that we are like just the most, the most of the most high in terms of like, you know, evolution. Probably true, but that isn't to say that we shouldn't force ourselves and challenge ourselves to say, well, if we're really going to do this, if we really have the mental capacity to think through all these complex things, maybe we got to step one more stride beyond just, you know, reproductive possession, right? In the way we think, in the way we kind of compete as men. I think the competition is natural.
Okay. So there's a book I was reading recently. It's called The Dude's Guide to Manhood. Finding True Manliness in a World of Counterfeits. This is one of those books I was telling you that I had in my stack there.
Well, that's a promising title.
The author's name is Darren Patrick.
Yeah, but I realize that you're about to go to the next question.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the point I really wanted to make about complimentary regarding positive attributes of femininity, women give birth to children. It is an incredibly vulnerable position.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like if we are built to be complementary pieces, and I think that it is clear that we are. Man's provision, male, masculine provision and protection is that because, in my opinion, with zero biology background, right? But because at some point, if a woman is going to give birth, she's going to have to be completely exposed, right? The world is dangerous. Someone needs to protect her during the time when she and then now a new baby are completely exposed and actually relatively defenseless if something were to attack, so to speak, if we just think about this in primal terms. So when the length or the extent of quote-unquote masculinity to me in terms of the complementary attribute is really just that, like, you have to do some shit as a woman that I cannot do and bless you because I don't want it. I don't want those problems. I don't want my body to go into revolt every month. I don't want to have to carry a baby to term. That's all you. The least I can do is now make sure you have a safe space to do the thing you were built to do if we're built as these complementary pieces. And so I think that that's kind of at least the imperative.
Yeah, and I can go with you on that in terms of I love how science kind of informs us in a way. And I will use my experience having worked at Apple, right? I was terrible at science in college for a while. And they're talking about, you know, especially biology. Biology, we're learning about basically life sciences. How does everything connect with each other? And this word would come up, ecosystem. Everything's working together. I was like, I don't get it. I do not get this. And then I got to working at Apple and like, hey, look, your iPad can talk to your iPhone and your iPhone can talk to your laptop and your laptop can talk to your desktop. It's all the Apple ecosystem. It can also talk to your watch. It's like, oh my gosh, this all works together in tandem with each other. And so, in a way, there's a way that science informs the very basics of our reality. And I do wonder if things like, okay, and this is going to be much more crass, but they say men pitch, women receive, right? Men are givers, women are receivers. So in a way, biology is almost informing how culture flows from that. So men provide. We're providing seed. So then, we need to provide protection. We need to provide clothing and housing, and we need to go to work. These are ideas that a lot of men grew up with. So we are provider from the very biological beginning of things, and women are receiving. And that's not to say that women don't do anything. Women, you know, are generally considered nurturers. Men are considered more warrior, right? And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but those were the images I grew up with. So this idea that men provide and women receive, and again, doing a lot of the heavy lifting as well by raising kids and nurturing them and being more tender and things like that, I do think that there is something that is informed by biology that can be extrapolated forward into the way that the rest of society is laid out in a way.
Absolutely. And I think it's important now thinking about today's society to recognize that these sorts of things only actually apply if you're interested in having kids.
Yeah.
If you're interested, like...
And my wife and I are not interested in having kids. I have a kid from before our marriage.
But even in the absence of having a child necessarily...
Some of this still plays out.
When you're quote-unquote playing house, like there is a paradigm that you are buying into to some degree. Much more so when you have kids and you're continuing the species and whatever, right?
But
I just think that it's important to recognize that that is not the only lifestyle.
Absolutely.
That we are absolutely talking within a certain context.
And we'll get into that on the back end. I do want to move forward.
Fine, Calvin.
So, again, talking about this book, this guy Darren Patrick, again, all cards on the table. He is a pastor, so he's coming from a particular point of view, which is religious Christian point of view, so nothing I haven't heard before. But he states in his book, a man without a quote, a man without a map will be a man without a spine. He'll lack both conviction and courage. A man without a map will be a man without a heart. He'll lack both passion and compassion. Unquote. Do you think there is a structured map for indoctrinating boys into the world of true manhood? Why or why not? And I think you already talked about this a little bit, Niles, in one of your responses earlier. But do you think there's a structured map for indoctrinating boys in the world of true manhood?
I think there is. And I apologize. I'm getting a coughing attack right now.
You need some water? I'll get you some water.
No, I got water.
Okay.
Fine. Just bear with me sounding like a, you know, dying animal. I think that there is a structured map. In the same way that I think a bowling lane like a lane at a bowling alley is a structured map, right? I think there's one place things are going. My Kung Fu teacher told me a long time ago, like, there's no such thing as a broken system. I think I might have even said this on the last podcast. Systems are perfect. They produce exactly what they produce. And I think that we have a structured map for indoctrinating boys into a world that drives them towards what we consider clearly to be true manhood because we haven't fixed it. And that true manhood is this sort of amorphous collection of not great and kind of toxic traits that are all keyed around dominance and control of women, of property, of space. That is, I think, what true manhood is in this country right now. I think that's what we are building. And I think to say that we are not building that is silly, right? When you look at the fact, you know, just when, whether you look at rape statistics or rape culture more broadly or any of these things, the sort of bane of patriarchy, right? We are clearly building a thing here in our men. And men are clearly the problem in that regard. It is not women. It is, and if it's not women and we're talking about gender, it's kind of got to be men because it certainly isn't, you know, the slowly emerging and often just disrespected trans community. So we can't blame it's men. Like, we are the problem, period, full stop. So yeah, I think that there is a map. I don't know exactly what that map is. I think it might more be, you know, negative space informing than it is a positive, you know, line. But it's like putting, you put gutter protection on the bowling lane and roll the ball down and some pins are going to get knocked down all the time.
Okay.
So I was looking up this oft misused Bible passage that I find it to be. So, like, just to build off, to go off what you're saying now, is like when I lived in LA, I'm sure you saw this too, it's a billboard frenzy in LA. And so you get a lot of intensity of messages that are directed towards certain people. And if you go through and look at what the billboards I remember for the 15 years I lived there that are meant to appeal to what I think we assume men are supposed to appeal to, cars and, like, you know, sports and stuff, everything there had like a, you deserve this, right? Like, you deserve this kind of like toy, or you deserve this kind of thing. So basically you had this like prolonged adolescence that were, you know, so like fast cars, fun games, like all this stuff, right? Where the stuff for women was what you would assume for women had so much more nuance and so much more, like, but men were supposed to be these kind of like consumers that liked fast things and sports and hot women, right? Like, that was pretty much what it was. But so you're talking about this guy being a pastor, right? And I think that he's probably implying that the Bible has sort of this roadmap, like that if you don't have a map for being a man, and so we're talking about how there isn't that much for men, that it's sort of more ambiguous, like that we're sort of confused about what that is, but we can define what women's roles are. So a lot of times, a lot of conservative friends and conservative colleagues of mine will talk about women being submissive to men. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you know where I'm going with this. Like, the Ephesians passage that talks about that, they use this at that weddings all the time. They sort of, wives, submit to your husbands. And then the next passage is, husbands, love your wives. But the whole thing is opened with submit to one another, right? And that often gets truncated, right? So, like, this idea of submissiveness as being like, women have to do everything men say, right? No, everyone's supposed to, when they're in a marriage, if we're talking about a marriage, if we're talking about this limited form of what it means to be a man in a marriage to a woman in a Christian map, right? There's been this truncation that serves one side more than another, right? That serves one power structure, if you will. And if you reframe it with the wives, everyone submit to each other. And the way that women submit is this way, and the way that men submit is this way, the complementary, and that's cool. But taking that whole thing off and just making submission being about a woman has been such an imbalance and caused all kinds of trouble, in my opinion.
The interesting thing about submission all around is it's an ugly word in our culture. And I think it goes to – there's no middle ground for submission for people when you talk about it. There is either the Nobody wants to submit. I mean, you can look at UFC, right? Like, you don't want to tap out. Do not submit. Do not submit. So neither party wants to submit to each other at all, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that negative side. One, there has to be a winner. Whoever submits is the loser, mm-hmm. right? And whoever does not submit is the winner. Then there's the other side of where our sexual appetites have, what I would say, have gone very awry from what they are meant to be. It's like there's a guy by the name of C.S. Lewis who talked about, you know, what would it be like if you went to
a guy by the name.
Not everybody who listens to the show knows who he is, right?
Okay, okay.
So he talks about sexual appetites having gone awry, where he said, you know, if you go to a striptease and you see a woman taking her clothes off, you know, it seems very normal. But what if you went to a location and everyone's sitting around a stage and someone walks out with a plate and they slowly lift up the lid off that plate and there's a steaming amount of food and people just start salivating and throwing money at that? You would think that something has gone wrong with their actual appetite, right? And so he talks about people looking at these kinds of, you know, looking at women stripping and something has gone wrong with their sexual appetite in a way. And so I think on the other side of things, submission is this very sexual thing. So it's now, submission is now part of BDSM, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the other side of things. Yeah. You were completely submitting to a man, or you were completely submitting to a woman in a sexual, voracious sexual appetite kind of thing. It is meeting a sexual need for you. And there's no really this middle ground of how do we submit to each other in a way that honors each other, whether you're religious or not,
right?
In a way that honors each other in a relationship, not there's a winner and a loser and a sexual appetite is being met. What is a way to do that in the middle? And this wasn't where I wanted to go at all in this conversation, but I do find that there's still some value in it, whether you're religious or not.
I mean, I think that we have such a terrible and unhealthy and imbalanced view of our sexual appetite.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, specifically in this country, not just in this country, though. Humans, I mean, like most, you know, patriarchal spaces, like we just have these terribly repressed views of what it means to be, you know, a sexual being, as though any of us are not, or many of us, as though many of us are not mostly driven by our sexual appetites. Like, we don't have, like, we shouldn't have to lie about that, you know? And I think that especially when you look at, in the context of masculinity, in the context of patriarchy, it's just, I think that there's an incredibly bad standard that we set, whether you're talking about strip clubs or the idea that, the thing about strip clubs that's so interesting is that it's the purest, it's one of the purest expressions of the power dynamic that most men actually want.
Mm.
If you look at their actions and not their words, right? They want, I mean, most men seem to go through life, many men, I will not say most men, many men seem to go through life thinking that if they achieve a certain level of status, if they are able to be successful by some metric, that they will then be able to get the woman that they think they deserve, and that there will not be choice necessary or compatibility necessary on the other side of that equation.
Right.
And that's exactly what a strip club is. It's if you have enough money, you can play. Mm. You know? And in a different way than prostitution, which happens in private. A strip club happens in public, which means that you can also be the dominant man in a strip club. You can be the most dominant man in a strip club. You can be the highest status having man there. And it's a purely transactional, very, very simplistic power structure that allows men to actually show dominance in ways that they cannot in a more discreet society. But it totally plays into that part of our egos, or that part of what this country has built our egos into being.
Yeah, yeah. We'll close out this side of the show with, I find that fascinating, and I did like the word that you use there. It's the purest form, mainly because I grew up in a culture where that's absolutely not pure, but I understand how you're using the word purest. It is the purest version of what men actually want.
It's uncomplicated.
But it's so interesting when I look at this kind of stuff, when I look at the well.
To be clear, not all men. Hashtag.
Right. Not all. Well, but it's interesting when I look at strip clubs, and it's not that I haven't been to a few. I've been to a few strip clubs. I always felt a little weird at a strip club because of how I was raised. One, but what I know it feeds into.
Yeah.
Right. The porn industry. I grew up watching porn. It was the biggest thing that you shouldn't do as a Christian person. Grew up watching plenty of it. I would still say that I'm very, very addicted to it, so I stay as far away from it as I possibly can. But not there aren't lapses. But at the same time, I also know what both of those industries feed into. Mm. And so when I see the purest form of what men want, how far those appetites go is what leads into some of the stuff that we're going to talk about on the back end. Because I will tell you right now that pornography is the number one contributor to sex trafficking. Now, this is something that we would say is absolutely abhorrent to human, to the flourishing of humanity. Oh, sex trafficking is terrible. We have all these sex trafficking PSAs. We don't want people to be kidnapped. We love movies where Liam Neeson goes down and single handedly takes out a sex trafficking ring to get his daughter back because he's got a particular set of skills. Doesn't know where they are, who they are, but he'll hunt them down. I love those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, the things that feed this sexual appetite that's gone awry in a way are the things that are much, much darker than I think people are willing to give credit to. And that is something that a lot of men do not own in terms of this this quest for being and becoming a man. But that being said, we're going to take a 10-minute break and we'll be back. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for waiting on the line for us. We're going to dive right back into questions, part two of this conversation about masculinity. So let's talk about aggression for a second, because society seems to kind of applaud aggression in men, and at least positive aggression in men, right? Sports is one area where we seem to applaud it, or defending your household against a would-be robber, things like that. But we also seem to excuse negative aggression in men. Case in point, there was a big boxing match a few weeks ago with Floyd Mayweather Jr. where he beat Conor McGregor from the UFC, right? Not really. Nobody didn't think he wasn't going to win that fight. But he is also known to have beaten women. There are other players in the NFL who I think – I can't remember the name of the player who knocked his girlfriend out.
Ray Rice.
So knocked his girlfriend out in an elevator, and the NFL knew about this long before the video came out. But when the video came out, they were like, oh, now we got to do something about it.
Did you have the thought at all about Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather coming up to the fight? I just remember thinking, I just wish it was possible for both of these guys to lose. I don't see how that's could possibly happen.
No, I did not. It was not going to happen.
It'd be a draw.
Yeah.
Much like the Canelo.
But I will tell you, Conor McGregor went a lot further than I thought he would. But either way, we applaud positive aggression, and we seem to excuse negative aggression. It's played itself out in everything from the religion of football every Sunday and the rise of UFC to the excuse of it was just locker room talk from a political candidate being defended by people. Is there something latently more aggressive about men? And if so, how do we direct that aggression in positive directions?
Yes, there is something more aggressive about men. Period.
Mm. Okay, so how do we direct that? How do we direct that in a positive direction?
Well, I think that becomes a discussion almost implicitly of rape culture to me. And I actually pulled up this. It was like there are a lot of like triangle and iceberg sort of graphics that I've seen floating around. But it's like a rape culture pyramid.
Mm.
And the foundation of it is victimization. It's the boys will be boys, locker room talk, rape jokes, sexist attitude, victim blaming, kind of like rhetorical normalization of sexual assault and of misogyny, right? And then you step up and now it's catcalling and and the stuff that is now external from men. So men to men, right, is where you basically create a victim class. Men to women without actual physical engagement in a lot of ways is like degradation, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm going to yell at you. And as long as men continue to co-sign these activities, it becomes okay, right? There's no consequence to it. And often there's validation from it, right? So now you're one of the guys or whatever. right? Mm-hmm. And then you continue to step up, and then you're talking. It's the four classes in this that I'm looking at is victimization, degradation, removal of autonomy. So that's dosing, coercion, groping, mm-hmm. safe word violations, mm-hmm. et cetera. And then there's, you know, explicit violence, which is rape, battery, murder, et cetera. But yes, men are the aggressors in 99% of any sexual assault in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's probably in the 80s, 90s of all assault generally in this country. So I think that there's enough statistics at this point just to say yes, okay. Men are the problem there.
Matthew?
Yeah, I think I think there's a bottling nature of the messages that we send. Looking back at some stuff that we've kind of moved around, sort of the stop being a pussy, be a man, boys don't cry. Those are things that when you think about what aggression is this sort of, there's an emotional component to it. There's a sense of moving from powerlessness to power, right? There's like this, maybe it nudges in that protector realm, perhaps. Maybe it stems from there, but it comes into this like feed of, okay, so am I protecting a person who's actually in danger, or I'm afraid of being seen as a person who is less manly than others and I have to protect my ego? Like that protector nature gets nudged, and there's an emotional component to all that, and there's an emotional like overpowering component. So when you have this culture that tells men boys will be boys, when they're like normalizes behavior that's aggressive and that is like beating up girls on a playground or stealing their toys and knocking things over and not picking it up as being that's boys will be boys. And then also telling boys that they can't cry when something happens to them. What you do is you create, I think there's a lot behind that, and I'm not like a psychologist, but I think it makes sense as a person who struggles with his own emotions. When I haven't had a chance to really process something, I'm more likely to outburst. I'm more likely to, you know, get to the end of a week that there's been a lot of stuff building up and I'm shouting at my wife about something or shouting at my kids. And I can recognize that when I haven't taken the time to really process that with something less aggressive, shall we say, then it comes out in outbursts. And I don't get physical. But I do think that there is this sort of powder keg we create with men, that you're not allowed to be this soft thing that talks about feelings or emotions. Like, you got to bottle that up. And I think then we just set up a more explosive rape culture. Like, that there is a truth to men being the aggressors, right? But we have kind of said, and so we're okay with that in a hyper sort of way that then creates a huge problem. And then you want to throw in things like, that Brock kid who like raped a girl out in the you throw in race to that, and like how he gets so many more chances than anyone else because he's white, we don't want to ruin his life, all that crap, right? You have all these other overlays, these intersections, right? But the whole thing comes down to, you know, there's different white boys will be boys, black boys will be boys. Like, there's a different thing, but it still comes to that.
Yeah, black boys will be grown men to get shot by cops right, in the middle of parks because they're walking around by
right.
themselves.
I'm not meaning to laugh at that, but I'm
I didn't. Just to be clear, I didn't take it as you laughing it.
Yeah, but like, you're right. Like, there's that whole thing, but there is the piece of boys will be boys that is where that's like elementary school, and then in high school it's locker room talk, and then it progresses, like you
but,
said.
Yeah, I mean, but there is a disparate masculine, like masculinization, we're gonna just call that a word, indoctrination of black boys into a hypermasculine culture that doesn't exist for white boys mm-hmm. in the same way at all mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. there are
what do you mean, because I don't know, like I'm again, it's fiction, I'm watching Friday Night Lights, it's football, I'm going in sports culture, I would think that it's very hypermasculine. Again, talking to my wife, like all of these responses are
in jock culture.
In jock culture.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there are not white boys who get brought into the same hyper masculine spaces. I'm saying that there is absolutely more latitude given to young white males in this country, young white men in this country, to express themselves in a litany of ways that mm-hmm. does not exist in the eyes of the country for young black boys.
Okay.
Which is why young black boys get shot by the cops when they haven't done shit.
Okay.
Because they are immediately seen as a threat, and the country their entire lives sees them and
okay. Consider, that makes more
considers
sense to
them
me.
That threat.
Yeah. That's a little
That's
more
all
specific.
I'm saying.
Okay.
Sure, sure.
And I think that then, you know, one of the things that Terrence also said, you know, when he was answering some questions was just that, you know, he felt like he had to be a grown ass man by the time he was 12 because there wasn't a father in the household, because he had to be the man of the house, mm-hmm. because he's forced into a role and forced to do and play that role in a very specific way. Right. And so I think that all of that contributes mm-hmm. when you start talking about subculture mm-hmm. to, you know, the way, you know, black men, urban black men are indoctrinated.
And that's an interesting bifurcation there, urban black men specifically, because, again, I think I said on the front end, I was raised in the military and my dad was come home, go to his room. It was the way we knew our dad cared for us as kids was selfish. It was the days he came home with Wildberry Skittles. Oh, he truly loves us. It was a banner day, right? He could go to his room any other day. If he didn't have Skittles, it was like, oh, he doesn't love us. But if he came home with Skittles, he loved us. But it was these white men that were in our lives, pouring into our lives, that have, I think, and the fact that we were in the military, so we were predominantly around white people. We were the second African-American family ever to move into Grosse Pointe. So again, predominantly around white people. Went to private Christian schools, predominantly around white people. When I went to college, predominantly around white people. Same thing now in this program. I'm in a master's program. So I think a lot of that missed me. And hold on one second. Yeah. I think a lot of it missed me until I got a little bit older. So there were options for me as a young black man where certain compliments were lost on me. Your credit. You know, your credit to your – like I was just taking them as, oh, well, you know, this is somebody who sees something in me. It's great. And then when I became more aware of my race was the first time I was called the N-word, and then I started to see these things where I was just another nigger.
Yeah. I mean, listen, microaggressions don't feel like microaggressions until you realize that you shouldn't be getting paper cuts walking to your door
right.
every day, right? When all you know is that that's the way – that's what you exist in.
Yeah.
Right. You don't know it's wrong. You don't know that that's not something you deserve.
But then there are other things that I wasn't aware of as a man that are aggressions, right? Coming from me towards mm-hmm. women.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. For instance, case in point, and it took a bunch of women on this show letting me know. No, it was on Facebook before we started this show. But I grew up, you pay a woman a compliment if she's pretty or you like something she's wearing and don't expect anything from her. That's what mm-hmm. I was taught that. Like, don't expect anything from her. Mm-hmm. She doesn't owe you anything. Like, oh, I'm on the right side. And then I grow up and I find out, yeah, do you know her? Don't offer her a compliment. I was like, wait, she's wearing something nice. Excuse me, ma'am, I don't want anything from you. I just wanted to let you know that I like your blouse. And she's going to accept that compliment. Oh, thank you. But she's feeling scared.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know. And so then I got this huge argument. Like, well, I'm just being nice. I'm a good guy. I'm not, like, raping her. There's a guy who's going to, like, not even compliment her and just, like, you know, pull her behind a dumpster like Brock. And, like, Calvin. You don't understand. Don't do that. Like, but right. It was so ingrained in me that this is chivalry. Hmm. I'm one of the good guys. And this good guy moniker.
Yeah, chivalry is a fucking lie.
Yeah.
No one wants to talk about this. But chivalry is a lie. Like, we talk about, you know, being a gentleman. So much of what we consider being a gentleman is actually really, really messed up.
Yeah.
And kind of patronizing.
Yeah. It's totally, you know, patronizing.
Like, all of it comes down to, again, the reduction of a voice.
Yeah.
And the reduction of agency in the counterparty, right?
Mm.
You know, even something as simple as, like, pulling out your chair,
mm.
right? Yes, that is, like, we can sit there and think about that. Like, that's very nice. That's a very nice thing to do. But also, all of that is the subtext under which you are saying you are not able to take care of yourself,
mm.
right? Yes, in a perfect world, in a world where everyone is, like, altruistic and just good humans,
yeah.
chivalry is great. But that yeah. isn't the actual world we live in. And, in fact, that is not the experience of so many people, especially when you talk about, like, a power group taking care of a disprivileged group.
Yeah.
In that way, it becomes incredibly patronizing. If every time I walked into a room, there was a white person telling me, well, because you're black, you can come sit up front.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so that I could better serve them.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the key.
Right.
It's not because they feel like I've been marginalized. It's not because they think, listen, I know you've had a hard day as a black person. Let me get you a good seat. That's not what's fucking yeah. happening. It's come sit up front so I can better not pay you what you are worth and get more value out of you into my system.
Yeah.
Right? That is literally what chivalry is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm going to protect you so that you can
the
serve me.
The possession thing, like, not the
right,
defense.
Not to defend you defend, so that you possess, then have right, a voice. Right. I'm going to defend my property.
The, yeah.
Chivalry is a weird extrapolation of the Second Amendment right.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. I hear that.
I hold the door for women.
I do too.
Okay.
And
I also walk on the car side of yeah, the sidewalk.
Yep. Just in case a car hops the,
right,
the curb.
Right. In the middle of intersections, I get incredibly anxious because I don't know which
stand,
side to stand on.
Yep.
Because on the first half of the street, I got to stand on the side of the cars that are facing us on the other side of the street. I have to like switch sides mid fucking
yeah,
Woodward.
Right. So,
you know, like it's
so then the question that comes out of that for me is and let me try to answer it. I'm going to ask a question and I'm going to try to answer it, and I want your commentary on this, because I wonder if there is something lost. And it's probably because, again, the way I was raised. There was a young lady that I was dating in college. Her name was Amanda. Didn't end up working in the long run, but there were a few things that she wasn't used to when I started dating her. For instance, I told her, we sat down, we had a conversation. It wasn't about her agency. It was, I'd like to hold the door for you. It does not, and I had to say, this does not mean that you are not capable of opening the door. What it means to me is that as your boyfriend, it is my great honor to serve you. That is why I want to do this. And so she just let me everywhere she'd go. Like, we'd stop at a door. Like, she could be ahead of me. She'd stop at the door and she'd let me open it. And that was to honor our relationship. But then it kind of moved into this space where she came to my dorm room one night and she goes, I did the stupidest thing today. So I got to this door and I just stood there. I just stood there. Like, you weren't with me and I just stood there and waited for someone to come open the door for me. And again, it wasn't that she wasn't able to do it. She just got so used to a gentleman opening the door for her. So I do wonder, like for me, because I come from this space where I'm quote unquote the good guy and I'm trying to be a gentleman and I'm trying to be chivalrous and you're saying it's bullshit. But for me, it was an honoring thing to do for my girlfriend. I would do it for other women. I'd only hold the door so long. Like, oh, look, if all y'all going to come walking through, I'm going to go through at some point. But for my girlfriend, it was an honoring thing. And I do feel at my core, because this is how I was raised, I feel at my core that there is something lost by saying that chivalry is dead or chivalry is bullshit or it is all in terms of how you can ultimately serve me in the end.
Yeah, but I want to shut up and let Matt talk. But I'm saying that chivalry is a part of a bigger system, which is bullshit, right?
But I was taught that out of a bigger system as well. I mean, it didn't start in a vacuum. I wasn't told this is what you do to be chivalrous my dad came up with this brilliant idea.
No. I hear you, but so I'm going to back us up to the Second Amendment analogy that I used.
Okay.
If you told the Founding Fathers that black folk were going to be able to have guns, that they were ever going to be citizens, ever, you would not have a Second Amendment in the Constitution.
Mm.
Not a fucking chance. You're saying the slaves are going to be able to have guns because they're going to be citizens one day? Then everybody can't have guns.
I don't know. Benjamin Franklin probably would have been like,
I don't know. Benjamin Franklin was a rapist.
No, true story, but he didn't have slaves. He said that was a moral evil.
Anyway. Excuse me. Thomas Jefferson was a rapist.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah, Benjamin Franklin might have been a cool dude. I feel like Benjamin Franklin was in
Benjamin Franklin's in his grave right now. Like, wait, what?
I feel like Ben Franklin is cool. We're going to leave Ben alone.
I didn't know that girl.
my point is just that if the Founding Fathers made that.
Slandered Benjamin Franklin, apparently.
Yeah, I did that. Okay. Niles Herron. I'm on Twitter.
Maybe he'll have a comeback like Frederick Douglass, right?
Right?
Yeah.
I heard he's a really.
He's getting very popular.
I heard he's getting a lot more recognition these days.
A lot of people listening to him.
People have spent a lot more of his money.
The point that I'm making is just that the Second Amendment alone is not a problem. The Second Amendment in and of itself is not a problem to me. What is a problem is that you can't analyze the Second Amendment without also analyzing the fact that black people are in the same document as 3/5 of a person. All of it is a part of the same system. Yes. Chivalry is not a problem. Chivalry is a part of patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot say, I'm just going to keep chivalry without also keeping the reason that it existed. which was that women had to be led places because women were property, right? Women weren't just walking the streets alone because men had to escort them places, mm-hmm. right? So because they are property. So the idea that now it's very gentlemanly is just like implicitly problematic is all I'm saying. Yeah, I'm not saying we should throw it away.
No, I'm still going to open doors.
And I think, we just got to know what we're
I think the pushback you're going to get from conservatives, especially religious conservatives, and again, that's what was instilled in me, even though you know I'm getting further and further away from a lot of the conservative ideas that I hold. I mean, literally – a couple years ago, I went to Southern California. I'm going out there next weekend. But the first weekend I was there, it was the Brock Turner case had gone on. And one of the guys in my class was like, don't you think she shouldn't be walking in that alley by herself? Like, why did she drink? So I was like, are you seriously saying this? But that's kind of the stuff that was coming out of this program. But at the same time, the people less crazy in the program would say that there is something to our makeup, there is something to our design. There is a particular calling that men have. You brought up the whole submission thing. You know, women submit to your husbands. You know, husbands love your wives. And I know people have gone back and forth, and pastors would be like, look, if husbands are loving their wives, women won't have any problem submitting to them because they know that they can trust their husband. They're going to lead them where they should be going. And this is me going back to, I think something is lost, but I think people who come from a religious underpinning are going to say that it didn't like start in almost like a Victorian era kind of idea. And that's not to say that ancient Near Eastern culture didn't have, you know, women as property. But I think that there is something.
Because they did.
Yeah, they absolutely did. But I think there is something to.
Matt, go on.
I'm losing my plot, but I think that there is something ultimately
something
to
that's lost.
This idea.
So
that,
what's
yeah.
interesting, I've heard you say it twice now, that like you had these really caretaking white male figures in your life. And for me, it was I have had those figures. And like I said, I threw my father, grandfather, and another family member under the bus. I'm trying to redeem that. But the first people that I had that really spoke to me were actually black men. And one of them, I've spoken on the show before, a man named Levi who was in prison, and he talked to me about some stuff he saw in me that really like and asked me to like, you know, be true. I think what has been lost is authenticity, and authenticity is a thing that in suburban white male culture, I see men wanting to adhere to some implied aspect of masculinity that's so strong and so unclear. I love that you, because I hadn't thought about how unclear it is. But there is this implication. It's defined by what it's not, right? It's not defined by what it is. It's defined by the things it's not. It's defined by don't be this, don't be that. That's not manly. That's not manly. Right. So be this. And anytime you slip into a place.
And it's and the things that it's not are almost always
womanly, feminine
traits.
Right? So right?
It's like masculinity is everything that has not been explicitly defined as femininity in so many ways.
So what I didn't share at the beginning was that I hated men so much that I thought maybe, I had this bully in eighth grade. He was a black kid actually who also wound up being the first person who taught me what forgiveness is about. But that's another whole story. And he would say that everyone doesn't like you because you're gay, because you're not this, you're not that, you're being this, you're being that. And so in college, I thought, well, maybe he's right. Maybe I hate men so much because I actually love men. And so I had a boyfriend for a while, also a black man, who taught me a lot about authenticity. And then that's another whole story.
We'll have you on to tell that story.
So I've explored all aspects of masculinity, I would say, and have a lot of interesting challenges from within that I saw within the gay community, too. Another whole thing. But the point I'm trying to make is its authenticity, that what I learned from black men was just be real. And there's a certain sense that I'm not trying to trivialize that, but like this, I struggle all my life with what I feel like I'm not living up to, what I'm not like, I'm not manly enough or I'm not successful enough. And all of these were very white-minded senses of stature. And black men sort of were like teaching me like just be real. And I'm oversimplifying that, but the point was I think there's this sense of men are trying to always be something more than they are.
I think at some point it's a question of what you define success as.
Sure. Right.
So, you know, not to continue this oversimplification too far, but like for a white man, the sky is the limit. Like success is the is the stratosphere.
Yeah.
And for a lot of black men, success is making it to 30.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's move forward. I think so, it's been really good.
So there are concepts of husbands and fatherhood, which have been changing. Men leave the household. Kids have got two dads. Fathers stay home rather than leave the house for work, be it as a because they are the homemaker while their wife works, or they have a job that they can stay in the house. Even in sitcoms, going back to the beginning of the sitcom, the father figure is usually presented as a buffoon, but with, you know, with a heart of gold. Have we lost the thread when it comes to men being fathers?
Men are dumb on sitcoms because men are dumb.
I want to give you that, and at the same time I'm going, you know what, I'm smart as fuck. I'm not dumb.
Yeah, but you're not funny though.
Yeah, I am.
You wouldn't be on a sitcom.
She lasted all my jokes.
Yeah. that's called submission.
Yeah, whatever. No, I mean, if you listen to the show, there's sometimes where I'm like, man, I crack myself up. And people text me messages and be like, man, that joke you told was hilarious. I'm not a comedian, but to the point, I will tell you that I think it's really hard for me as a dad. You know, my ex-wife left me while she was pregnant. I was on a mission trip in Mexico, so I couldn't do nothing. She took everything. It was my fault. I understood why she left, but
to your point,
it was tough. So, but I'm sorry. It wasn't because I was dumb. We had tough communication issues. But either way,
and to her credit, it seems like while you're out of the country is the time to go.
It seems like it.
Yeah.
But either way, her parents are very happy about that. So my daughter is now 15 years old. She just turned 15 a couple weeks ago. And I will tell you, not having daughters in the house, and I would love to hear from you, Matthew, on this, because you have daughters in the house. You are a father with kids in the house. Niles, do you have kids? I don't think you have any kids right now. Okay. So I'd like you to answer this next, but I will tell you that it is hard for me to watch shows where the dad is lovable, has a heart of gold, but he's this bumbling buffoon.
Yeah.
Because of all the hard work that I put into being a father, even one who is physically distant. I am not emotionally distant. I make sure that, because I read all the things about, you know, the dad who's absent, like their daughters grow up to be this, that, and the other, like, because they're all, and they go after these guys because they're looking for love and acceptance from their dads. And that
you
might
wanted
be a
to communicate
joke.
With your daughter so bad you got a Snapchat account because that's the only way
I did, right.
To
you. She wouldn't talk on regular text. I'd be texting her, and I texted her mom. I was like, hey, did you take her phone? Is she grounded or something? Because her mom would do that. She's like, no, she only responds on Snapchat. So I got Snapchat. Still don't know really how to use it other than how to chat. And so I'll text my daughter. Apparently you can like get rid of your chats. And my daughter had to teach me how to save the chats for legal purposes. Either way, it's really hard for me to watch shows like that where dads are the buffoons who sometimes and the wives are getting it all right, because I'm a dad who's out here and I'm working really, really, really hard, which is why I think on the flip side of that, this is why I think shows like This Is Us is resonating so hard with people right now, because you do see a father, and it's not that there aren't shows like this, but you really do see a father who is striving very, very hard. Other shows like Parenthood, same thing, dealing with family issues, fathers who are there, fathers who you see fuck up, fathers who are like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing right now, but I'm going to try to do my best.
Authentic.
Yeah. Right. So I do, that does resonate with me, but I think the cultural meme is a big bumbling buffoon dad, Homer Simpson, the Peter Griffins, the before that you even had
Kevin
the family.
Kevin James character.
Yeah, Kevin James, Yes Dear as well. So all these characters where the husband doesn't know anything. You don't have your Cliff Huxtables anymore. Don't get me started on Bill Cosby. That's not what I want to get on.
Cliff Huxtable was also kind of an idiot.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Because, I mean, you can go back to the very first episode.
He was a doctor.
Where Theo's like,
you.
I want to graduate from college.
I hear you,
right?
but
I'm not going to college.
But Cliff was still the color guy of the parents.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
He was like, funny.
Oh, no. I just always thought he was intelligent. I'm like, when I think of shows that we don't have anymore, all of Cosby stuff aside right now, I didn't see Cosby.
We're not talking about the fact that Bill Cosby is a rapist. We don't have to go there right now. It's fine.
You just did, Buckle.
But even in that show, Camille.
Claire, right?
Claire.
Yeah, but she's always Camille. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, that's Bill Cosby's wife. Like in my head, like I don't call him Cliff. I call him Bill.
No,
Camille,
I just trying to remember. Sorry,
the character. You know, Claire Huxtable.
Claire Huxtable is like Felicia Rashad, right?
Yeah.
That's who I wanted. I mean, like, you know, if you said you can't have your mama who you want, like, it's Felicia Rashad every day, twice on Sunday. It's no problem. Yeah. But my point is just that, like, of those two. If you're talking about Bill Cosby or Felicia Rashad, like, Bill Cosby is the slapstick guy of that duo.
Yeah, he was more fun.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is kind of the
But
the
I never got the idea of a buffoon.
No.
I never not got a the buffoon. Idea that he was
so
a
he was kind of playing but that, listen, that yeah. archetype.
Lois on Family Guy, she's not the brightest bulb. Marge, she's not all that great either. You know, I mean, part of this is just the fact that it's a sitcom.
Yeah.
How many, like, in situational comedy, like, how many women are leading? Like, the funniest characters lead.
Well, dumb is funnier than smart.
It just is,
to better,
right?
Jokes.
Like, Three Stooges. I mean, like,
jokes.
My so point is, like, thing, I don't. Yeah. That does, but I'm also not a father, and I never feel attacked by that by that structure ever. Like, right. I just, because, you know, I'm always just kind of like, I'll laugh at my dad. It's fine. Like, it's fine.
Yeah, but I would say, like, my Darcy always hated Everybody Loves Raymond because it was like this sort of modern show, but he was definitely buffoonish, right? Like,
oh, totally.
And I see where you're going with Cliff Huxtable. Like, he was the comedic relief, but that gave him the edge on a comedic show, right? So I can say that, you know, as the dad,
yeah, he's got to tell more jokes. He's also the one who gets paid the most, like. You know, Ray Romano
right.
got paid way more than his wife's character did.
Yeah, Patricia Heaton,
And that's because he had all the jokes.
Right, yeah.
So he's gonna be kind of fun.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought about it. But anyway, so as a dad of two daughters, I do sometimes find that I need to try to lighten things up, right? Like, when there's a lot going on, I will step into that role. But it is, I don't appreciate those shows, and I do love This Is Us for all those complexities. I think that when you talk about a roadmap for modern fathers, we're somehow expected to be these providers still. And then we're also expected to be more nurturing than our fathers were meant to be. And we're supposed to be able to allow our wives to go back to work. So now you see the new sort of buffoonery is like dads wearing like the baby gear, and they're walking around not knowing what they're doing.
Baby Bjorn.
Well, yeah, Baby Bjorn. There, I can remember it. It's already evaporated.
I'm the only non-father in the room. Right. I knew what that was.
But I blocked it out of my memory. It's like black. But you see on those shows, you see the well-meaning, like, older woman stepping in and be like, oh, here, let me help you with that, right? But, like, here's sort of tying some stuff that I struggle with my daughters. I have one who's really affectionate and one who's like, I'll shake your hand, Dad. And she's five and she's fierce and she's awesome. And she's really emotional right now because she just started kindergarten.
You've got a 5-year old girl who's standoffish and polite. all right.
But one thing I've been noticing, right. And I'm thinking about this in terms of how rape culture gets infused into little girls. Right. So I was at a family gathering and I had to leave early from this, and so my girls were there, and another family member said, like, you know, give your dad a hug, right? Give your dad a hug. And then Charlotte gave me a hug, my oldest one, and Ruby was like, no. And then somebody said, but he's going to feel sad if you don't give him a hug. And I was like, that's true, actually. I will. But then I was like, that's really messed up, right? Because what is being indoctrinated into her is that you've got to physically interact with men, be it your father, be it your boyfriend down the road, to make them feel okay, right? And to me, that is the buffoonery, right? Like that, like, men are so fragile that women have to use their bodies to make them feel okay about themselves. So I'm like, so now with Ruby, like, I tell her, like, I would love to hug you, but if you want to do a handshake now, high five, fist bump, whatever, I just want some connection with you before I go, right? That's our middle ground. But I'm thinking about how little girls are told, right? you got to make your dad happy, right? And that just – and I drove away being like – I wanted to turn back around because I was like – I couldn't – and then it hit me. I'm like, oh, we're teaching her that she has to use her body.
And I do wonder if that Alan, I'm just going to tell you that goes both ways, because there are times where I am fragile.
Yeah.
And my wife says, come to me. Yeah. Right. And there are times where my wife's like, I don't feel sexy. I don't feel pretty. And I'm just like, come to me. And so I wonder if sometimes we just let things be. And I get it. The overarching message that masculinity and toxic masculinity and patriarchy can send to women, for sure. But I also wonder if that action prepares us to be human towards one another in relationships.
It's about agency.
Right.
Because it was not.
Right, and you brought that up several times, which is good.
Yeah, but it was not in Matt's story, right? That he said, I am sad and a hug would make me feel better if you would like to hug me.
Right. I added that later.
Right. But I mean, no, right. But I'm saying
somebody else said, if you don't give your dad a hug, right? Yeah.
It was compelling his daughter.
And I think that's an important distinction. The agency is
so that she could validate and make happy the male figure in that story. And I don't know. I mean, like, we can do over-analysis.
And I get it on the agency.
Sure.
I get on the agency thing. What I'm
saying is, but we wouldn't do that to a boy. You wouldn't say that to a little boy. You wouldn't say, go give your dad a hug or he's going to pick, right?
I wonder if it's a boy-girl thing. I mean, I get who it affects the most, and it affects women the most. But what I'm getting at ultimately, and then we got to close down the show, unfortunately, is does it make us more human in that there are moments where my wife, again, doesn't feel sexy, and I say, come to me. Now, in that moment, more often than not, if she's not feeling sexy, I'm not seeing her as sexy either, because I'm like, you got to carry yourself. I can't make you feel sexy for yourself. You got to feel sexy for yourself.
Well, self-esteem.
But I'm using my my agency and saying, come to me. And even though I don't want to do this right now, it is important for you to feel X way about yourself. Therefore, I am going to self-sacrificially do this. And maybe people don't think through it that way, but that's how, if I'm forced to sit and think about it right now, that's what I think ultimately is at the bottom of it. Now, can that go astray? Can that go wrong? Absolutely. But I do think that there is something in that response
And
that can be a good thing as well.
And so the question for me becomes, does that happen on an even playing field?
Right. And I think that's a good question.
Every time that happened, it had to be me as a black person validating a white person and saying, no, you're not racist. I know you're not racist.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. I'm just picking a thing that
no,
I
get.
It's good.
It's valid for this show. Right?
If that were what was happening, at some point, you are asking me to sacrifice of myself. Like, you are now using my body, my agency, my voice, my position to validate you.
Yeah.
Not because I am me. And that's where there becomes a problem.
Mm. Well,
masculinity can't exist at the cost of femininity.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're going to get into that next week, which I think is a good place to end. Thank you so much to both of our guests, Niles, Matthew. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. Always love having you here. Hopefully we can have you on again for a final episode of this series. But thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and last season, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com, and we'll get back to you. To our live listeners, thanks for tuning in. To those of you listening on iTunes, Google Play, or SoundCloud, thanks so much for subscribing. Please leave us a rating. And tune in next week, where Kent and I continue our three-week series, Battle of the Sexes, with a panel titled, What is Femininity? See you next week.